Well, welcome to the latest episode of Kennedy's Medical Law Matters podcast. I'm Rob Tobin, Head of Medical Law Group here at Kennedy's, where we act on behalf of NHS and public sector organisations and private healthcare providers on all aspects of healthcare and medical law. For those new to this Medical Law Matters podcast, we use this as an opportunity to discuss topical issues in medical law, hope to generate some interest and debate among listeners. Over the previous episodes, all available on your usual platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, we've discussed best interests, the law around the medical treatment of children, assisted dying, mental capacity, media scrutiny, amongst other things. And today we're going to discuss the topic of futility in medical care and treatment, an incredibly emotive, thorny topic, which covers all realms of individual rights, patient autonomy, equity of opportunity, patient harms, moral harms of clinicians, resource allocation, etc., etc. I'm delighted to be joined today by a real titan in the field of medicine and indeed many other fields, Professor Hugh Montgomery. I will let Hugh introduce himself, but I will just let guests know, because he's probably too modest to say so, that he's not only a consultant in intensive care medicine and a professor, but also he's known as a geneticist, and he discovered a gene code that influences physical fitness, and he was awarded an OBE in 2022 for services to intensive care medicine and climate change. Hugh, do you want to pick up on that and introduce yourself probably a bit better?
No, not at all, Rob. That's really good of you. So yeah, I'm an NHS lifer. I graduated in 1987. I've trained in general medicine, cardiology and intensive care, and I only practice intensive care, which I still do in a hospital in London. And I've run research, as you describe, and I've sat on the council of the Intensive Care Society as well. I started my intensive care career in 1989 was my first job. So I've been at it quite a long time. So I guess what I can give you is at least age, if not wisdom.
Thank you. I'm sure you can give a lot of wisdom. We first met, I think, through the Intensive Care Society during the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
When I had the privilege of sitting on the National Critical Care Committee, which you chaired, navigating the challenges of intensive care and in all the myriad difficulties that the pandemic threw up. And I suppose some of those issues will no doubt come up today. And let me perhaps start by introducing the discussion around futility and medical treatment. In the world of medical law, particularly when we're dealing with serious medical treatment decisions in the Court of Protection, the word and the concept of futility does come up, and it understandably generates quite a great deal of reaction, negative particularly, understandably, from the patients and their relatives. Often when you as clinicians are deciding whether a treatment should be offered or given to a patient, admission to ICU even, perhaps resuscitation in the event of respiratory or cardiac arrest, being placed on a ventilator, having life-sustaining treatment continued, you will no doubt consider if a treatment is of benefit to a patient or it's futile. And I'm probably simplifying it too much. And this has come up very recently in the case, in the Court of Appeal case of Townsend, which we'll no doubt discuss, where those very clinical decisions, the ones that have been put on the table as options, now deemed to be best interest questions themselves, certainly for patients lacking capacity. So what do you understand, Hugh, by the term futility? And is it the right term to use at all?
It's a really good question. I can speak as Hugh rather than as a healthcare professional, as Hugh who works on the intensive care unit. And I don't tend to talk about futility. And the reason I don't is because of the ambiguities surrounding the word, because what is futile? Well, I suppose futile, you might say, is it wouldn't work if you were to do it. But it depends on what you mean by work. Would it work to save this person's life? That might be one question. Would it work to improve their quality of remaining life? That might be a very different question, because that might be palliative. And what people describe as futile really is very culturally and personally dependent. So if you look at something like duration, there are religious beliefs in the world that would say that one microsecond of life is important and would be important to that person because that was their belief before. So don't talk to me about it being futile because it's not giving them an extra year or day. The second, of course, is futility to say, well, even if I were to give you that, it might give you a quality of life that you would not want. And what I've learned over the years is that's very hard to judge. We used to say this about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So, well, if you stick them on a ventilator, you're going to leave them in a way they wouldn't want to live. And it turns out that actually people get quite used to a quality of life. And I remember when I was working on a chronic ventilation unit, having a chap in who was in an iron lung and had been since the 1960s when he got polio on his honeymoon. And he'd been completely paralyzed and dependent on a ventilator ever since. And I said to him when he came in, I'm so sorry, that must have been the most awful last, 30 years. And he said, oh, not at all. I've had a fantastic life today. You know, I've got a mirror. I can read books. People come and talk to me. I've had a fantastic life. And I think that is important to recognize, that people do get used to things they wouldn't otherwise have thought they would accept. And we find this too with really devastating injuries that, for instance, getting locked in from a brainstem stroke. I suspect, I'm guessing, Rob, that you'd feel like me. The idea that you could never talk or communicate ever again, except maybe through a slight eye twitch, sounds like hell to me. But if you talk to the people who manage these patients longer term, whilst for some people it is a living hell, for some, humans get used to things. So I don't tend to talk to futility. I tend to pick up on the thing that you mentioned earlier on, which is this issue of best interests. And that really is a much more humane way of saying, doctors are much better bookmakers than prophets. We're much better at odds than we are in certainty. And that has to come into play. So if you were with me, Rob, and you were 86 with heart failure and, let's say, a neuropathy that you just got, the conversation might be, well, look, I can put you on intensive care. There's probably a 60%, 70% chance I'll get you off it. But actually, you're probably going to be in hospital for 7 or 8 months afterwards. You'd have, if you weren't really that good at home before, you're going to be very, very much more limited. And in fact, we might be talking about going to a home rather than home. Then we can start navigating a course that suits the patient. And sometimes patients have very clear views. If the patient can't talk, you have to try to ascertain that from the family. And we can come on to that in a moment. That can be much more complicated because family's input can be sometimes exceedingly clear. Rob would hate that. He would not want to have a chance of carrying on living paralyzed. So he wouldn't want you to play the odds. He's always said that over dinner. The answer is extubated now. It's very clear he'd be furious if you were to continue. Or sometimes they'll say, no, Rob really would take those chances and would be happy as long as you see the grandchildren. The problem is you've sometimes got a lot more emotion in there. There can be family conflicts. There can be religious beliefs that some people hold and not others. There can be guilt that they should have done more. Or the guilt of going, I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I let these doctors supervise a comfortable death for my mum. So that's where it gets really difficult, is trying to, sometimes, not always, to work with families to work out what best interest actually is. So it was an incredibly long answer. It's quite a short question.
It is a fantastic answer, and you've opened up all kinds of questions for me to ask or to just explore. I mean, I suppose one of them is that impossible question that we're all petrified of being asked, either as patients or as relatives who are helping to relay what we believe to be our loved one's best interests. And that's, what do you want? You know, what would you tolerate? And in the case of the incapacitated patient, what would your loved one want? And I'd never really thought about it to that extent, where you can only know what you can know now in terms of what you tolerate and what you regard as acceptable. And none of us, for example, in ICU, I mean, as I understand it, and I've seen some studies on this, there are some people who do, survive is the right word, but get discharged from ICU and then relay the real burden that they encounter, or burdens that they encountered, even the relatively innocuous things like being woken up every so often by beeps, or being woken up because the nurse wants to check or move you to stop getting pressure sores, or check your temperature, or wake you up to check that you're sleeping well. All of those things must be quite intolerable, no?
Well, these are really good points, Rob, because it isn't just would you, Rob, or do you think you, your children, would say Rob might want to survive in 4 months' time with a level of paralysis or whatever? That's one question. But you're quite right. The other bit is the journey to get there. And I don't want everyone to think that intensive care is universally completely horrible, but it's you've got to be tough mentally and physically. It's for an elective surgical patient, it's relatively benign. If you come in with multi-organ failure and you're probably sick, you are in for, sadly, a really tough time. You're probably on a breathing machine, so you've got a tube down your throat. You can't cough. You can't talk. You'll be sedated with drugs that will make you hallucinate. That, with the illness that you get, lots of inflammation, most people get hallucinations, some of which are very nice. Michael Rosen is on record. I'm not breaking confidences. You can look him up in his interviews. I looked after Michael with COVID. He had some very nice hallucinations, which you all rather enjoyed. Didn't quite understand what they were, but they were fine. A lot of people don't. They see the clock in front of them melting and coming towards them, trying to smother them. If they're partially aware and they're having a CT scan, they think they're being loaded into a crematorium and about to be burned alive and they can't say anything. And we know that the outcomes is they have tubes shoved in, nines in their necks, they have urinary catheters, they're probably fecally incontinent, they probably have potentially got a tube up their bottom end to drain poo away, they can't eat. They don't see their friends and relatives in the same social congress. They're staring at the same bit of ceiling. And in fact, I looked at the data. The CIA published their manuals for torture from the 1960s about how you break people. And there were 20 features of how, if you really want to break someone mentally, what you do to them. And we do all of those things on intensive care, not with the intention to break people, but just as a consequence. We give them mind-altering drugs. You've alluded to the fact we show them bright lights all hours of the day and night. There are noises that are irregular, including alarms, and some of them are loud. We demonstrate the captor's omnipotence. In other words, they're lying there and I stand over them and they've got no chance of escape, which is another one, no chance of escape. There is forced nudity. There may be people who find genital exposure or excrement difficult. We do all of these things for people. And so it's a really tough line. You would pick up on your other points, though, as well. Whether you're prepared to go through it is also something we have to really think carefully about, because there are two bits.
Yeah, but I suppose the more extreme cases, or the ones that we tend to see and the ones that tend to go to court, are the ones where the clinicians are fairly certain as you can be, that this patient is not going to be discharged from ITU and they're not going to get better. At best, they might stay the same. In the MDT's view, the multidisciplinary team's view, there is no realistic prospect of recovery or even consciousness. And from a clinical perspective, it's fairly, as much as these things can be, it's fairly clear cut that the treatment, if there is treatment, or I suppose the continued life-sustaining treatment, i.e. ventilators, organ support, is, to use that word, futile, i.e. it's not going to provide any benefit, it's not going to cure, and we'll come on to whether that's the right test in a minute, but, and importantly, it's going to cause a burden. So if, I know we don't like balance sheet tests in medical treatment decisions anymore, but on the one hand, there is no prospect of recovery. On the other hand, all this treatment will do is cause a burden or pain or harm. So in those situations, how do those conversations go between you and the relatives when you're trying to persuade them to accept? I know they're not the necessary decision makers, unless they've got a lasting power of attorney or something, but agree with you, accept that it would be in their loved one's best interests to stop this treatment.
Yeah, so those are really good points. So what we're talking about here is someone who suffered catastrophic brain injury for some reason. Let's suppose a common one, out of hospital cardiac arrest, a very, very long downtime, and the brain is clearly, severely, and by every objective measure, irrevocably damaged. But the patient is not brainstem dead, let's say, by that sort of technical definition. The first thing is to try, I always try to be open from the very, very beginning, because sometimes if you can help people understand it very early on, they will make different decisions. And I can give you an example of a case I managed within the last few weeks of a young woman, actually, who suffered an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And the downtime, that's the time for which resuscitation was continued, was well over 2.5 hours. And she arrived in the emergency department with very, very, very limited brain function. And it'd be very clear to anybody that waiting for X number of days to do lots of specific tests to demonstrate that was not going to give us further information. And in that situation, having the conversation with the family to say, you know, I think in terms of survival, I think it's very, very unlikely, even with intensive care, that your mum, your wife, will be alive even with that treatment. But furthermore, the indignity, if she's aware of anything at all in the indignity of suffering, will be pretty unpleasant. And I don't think, as I say, there's a chance of her surviving, but if she did, she would survive with very, very limited brain function. And actually, the family then just said, well, thank you. She really, really wouldn't want that. Do you know what we thought that when we watched that for 2.5 hours? We don't think this is humane. Please, would you let her go now? And I put her on the intensive care unit to pull the tube out so that the husband could get on the bed and give her a cuddle. And she got an end that was dignified and so forth. So sometimes one is able to have the conversation early and a family will understand where you're coming from. Sometimes they will not. And it's difficult for families in these circumstances because they often love their family member very, very dearly, even if there isn't a religious belief that they'll get resurrected in some way or whatever it might be. They don't want to bear the guilt of saying, yes, let her go, because they have to live with it. I often say to family members, I will hear what you say, but you must allow me to try to make the decision for you because I'm paid to bear guilt and you're not. But sometimes they find that difficult. And then the longer you go on, they find it harder because the patient might breathe, even if they're on a breathing machine, they might breathe a bit. They will twitch in a way that can be interpreted as purposeful. So we often find people saying, well, I asked Dad to move his finger and he did. And actually, if you do it yourself, and you'll find that 1 in 5 times the twitch will coincide with when you said something. But you could see why that would be not interpreted. If you sometimes squeeze someone's hand, they will reflexly get a reflex contraction that can make it look as if they're consciously responding. So patients can be misled by that. And that's when the difficulties arise. And we find it quite often, I know you've been in these situations too, Rob, that what we do is, we're not cavalier, and I hope your listeners would understand that we as intensivists take these decisions incredibly seriously. So we will generally ask our colleagues, I have 6 colleagues in intensive care where I work, and I'll ask several of them to give me an independent assessment of their own, unbiased, what do you think? And if we all agree, then we can take that back to the family. The family will often say, well, we want a neurologist. Well, we've actually usually got a neurologist. And if the neurologist agrees, they'll often say, well, we want second opinions. So we'll go to another hospital to get another intensivist, and we'll go to another hospital to get a neurologist. And they would all agree. But by this point, you're often in a situation where, in the end, none of that is going to convince them, because they still think that mum might recover, or they still think that God might save them, or whatever it might be. And it's those situations where we have to go to a court of protection. And we try to say to families, this isn't about us fighting you. This is us going to the court of protection because we can't agree on what's in the best interests of mum. So we're going to ask a really experienced person who's good at weighing evidence to tell us what the right answer is. And that's the spirit with which we go into this. And I know that you and I, Rob, were involved in the case, and you were very surprised when the family arrived and I went over to talk to them and the son gave me a hug. And yeah, I remember you saying to me, I've never seen that before. And that's because we try to not make this adversarial.
Completely. And if the, you know, very strong message for anyone listening is that the Court of Protection is not an adversarial place, although it's not designed to be anyway. But sometimes these cases do come quite fraught with emotion. Yeah, and it's interesting because you were talking about that example of people sort of clinging on to hope of recovery, hope of discharge from ITU. But there obviously are cases where people accept there is no prospect of recovery, and yet they're still, either for religious values or perhaps just because that's what their loved one would want, are of the view that treatment should continue at whatever cost. And there was the case that I didn't start all this, but sort of put it down in writing in the Supreme Court was the Aintree case back in 2013. So that, just for listeners, is quite an interesting comparison between the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court. So it involved a 68-year-old man who had been in ICU for several months, and he'd been in there with multi-organ failure, cardiac arrest, stroke, infections, and was dying. And the clinicians were of the view that treatment was futile. In their view, there was no real prospect of curing, or at least enabling him to be discharged from ITU. And so in the Court of Appeal, that was effectively the test. They said that life-sustaining treatment could be withdrawn because it was futile unless it could offer real prospect of curing. Whereas in the Supreme Court, they said that was the wrong test because we have to look, as you said at the beginning, we have to look at each person as an individual. And whereas one person might well regard that as the appropriate test, if you like, another person might think, well, it's not about curing. It's about what I would regard as acceptable, or what I would regard as my quality of life. I remember an earlier podcast with Dr. Zoe Fritz. She discussed a patient of hers who said, as long as I feel the sun on my face, I'll be content. And that's quite sort of evocative image of that particular person would regard as tolerable and enough to bear all of the other burdens for her to continue living. So it is about those very individualized concepts, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you mentioned earlier on this issue of whether a treatment is overburdensome, which is something we do have to consider, which is, I guess, where we started talking about, is the pain worth the gain? So is what we're doing to this person, when we try to weigh what they would wish for themselves, were they able to communicate it, which of course is key, where are we in that? So if, for instance, you've got someone who is profoundly brain injured, and we do not believe them to be conscious, but if they are, their awareness will be minimal and likely only really to be aware of the unpleasant nociception, so pain or discomfort, and can't generate the pleasure, for instance, sitting in an ITU bed of warmth, of the sun on your face, or seeing your grandchildren, or being able to listen to music, or any of the things that might bring pleasure. Then that in many cases would be considered overburdensome, that having a tube up your, well, whichever orifice, into your bladder, one up your bottom end for your poo, lines elsewhere, a tracheostomy tube, nurses suctioning you, which is unpleasant, it makes you cough, being turned all the time, etc., being fecally incontinent potentially, that those things, for no pleasure being possible now or in the future, one would suggest in many of those cases that intervention is overburdensome. And that is, along with these other issues of best interest, those for me are the big guiding principles, the best interest of the patient, and whether the intervention is overburdensome, and trying to understand genuinely, but not as lip service, if that patient were alive, what it is they would say to me, and about what I was doing to them. And sometimes, you know, I've had these conversations with families, and I sometimes say, let's ask ourselves this question. If they were able to talk to you now, what do you think they'd be saying? And if you did get them through this and you leave them potentially in state X or Y, and they were able to talk to you, what would they say? Would they say thank you, or would they say damn you? And I have to do that as a doctor, and the family really need to think that through for themselves. Mostly, I have to say, as you well know, mostly families do have a good understanding of what their loved one would want. And there's very rarely conflict, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And given the number of treatment episodes there are on a daily basis, there are very few cases that go to court, which is a good thing. But
well, I mean, I should jump in with one other thing, Rob, because I think since we're talking quite broadly here, part of the problem we've got is that when things go wrong suddenly, for the reasons I've discussed, people will bounce into a decision based on fear or the C6 syndrome or whatever. And it's much better to have thought these things through before. The problem is if you go and see, you know, if you come in and see me for some reason and I've got an ingrown toenail, I'm meant to talk to you about end of life. And I say, well, Rob, would you like CPR? And you go, well, I don't know. What's that? I say, oh, you know, bouncy on the chest, electric shocks and stuff. And you go, well, why am I having that? And I say, well, I don't know why you're having it. It might be the heart, I don't know. And you go, what would the outcome be? And I go, well, I don't know. Depend on why you'd had it and how long it went on for. To which your answer, therefore, is, well, I don't know if I want CPR. And if I said, would you want chemo? You go, well, why am I having it? And what would the side effects be? And how long will I live? And I go, well, I don't know. In which case you say, well, it's a dumb question then. We're trying something at the moment which we think is easier, and I commend it to you as a thought for you and your family and your loved ones and anyone else listening to this, which is to have the conversation over a beer or at the dinner table, saying, look, Rob, I want you to imagine a film, and it's called The Life of Rob. And it's been brilliant. It's been really, really long. And it's got romance and thrills and comedy and adventure and a bit of sadness and pathos. It's just had it all. It's been a great film. But we're coming to the end now. We're about to fade to grey and roll the credits. And the question I want you to have decided is, what do you want the final frame of your film to look like? And most people can come up with an answer. Oh, I'd like to be at home in my own bed, pain-free. I'd like the dog on the bed with me, or I'd like my partner next to me, or I'd like the kids there or not, or and I'd like this music in the background. And at that point, you say, okay, well, Rob, you're the only person who knows that. So first thing is tell everybody in your family. And secondly, whenever a doctor offers you a treatment, go, what are the chances of success? You know, 50%, 80%. What does success look like? So what? How much more life do I get, for instance? What's the price I pay for that success? You know, what suffering goes with it to get there? And then finally, what does it do to the chance of me getting my final frame? Because if the answer is a 50% chance of getting an extra 14 weeks of life, but at the price of feeling sick and losing all your hair, and you might die in a general ward or an emergency department at the end, then you might say, well, actually, do you know what? Maybe I'm going to move to the palliative care route and concentrate on living life now and dying with dignity and comfort in the place I choose. And it's really helpful for us as intensivists when patients have had those thoughts before, because it makes it easy for everyone. Families say, oh yeah, Bob always said he'd never want to be on a breathing machine, or Bob always said he would never want to die in intensive care. Then everyone's on the same page at once.
Yeah, I completely endorse that. And, you know, for listeners, what he was, I suppose, talking about ultimately is advanced decisions to refuse treatment, but not just advanced decisions to refuse treatment, advanced decisions or advanced statements, just setting out what your wishes, values, and feelings are. And this shouldn't be constrained to the elderly. It should be everyone. We should all be doing it, just so that we've got it clear for that, God forbid, situation where something catastrophic happens at any time, and it can happen to any of us at any time in our lives, to ensure that we control that last frame.
I think you're right. I mean, I'm 63 and I have a will because that's sensible. I've had one for years and years and years. And I do have my lasting power of attorney. As you know, you can do it online through the government site. I've got one lasting power of attorney for financial affairs. So if I'm incapacitated, you know, the bailiffs don't come round. That's all gets sorted. And I have got lasting power of attorney for my medical decision-making if I'm incapacitated. And actually, I left all the boxes blank for if this, then that, or if that, I wouldn't want this. Because I've got a few medical friends who know me incredibly well. And I've just chosen one of them who I think knows me well enough to make a call or knows who to ring up and say, hello, everyone. Look, this is what's on the table. I don't think he would want that, would he? And I think we'll get the wisdom of a few people. It depends if you've got someone you can trust well enough. I think I do. So I filed mine, and it's given me quite a lot of peace of mind, actually. But I have also made clear where my limits lie. And this is not, I don't want anyone to feel, listening to this, that I'm telling them, steering them down a particular path. But my ceiling of care is not to go to an intensive care unit for lots of different reasons. And it's not because I don't think people should. And it's not that I hold it against anyone who wishes to. It's just that for me, if I drop down dead suddenly, or I'm unable to think particularly in loose capacity, that sounds to me like a pretty quick and good end. And I'm much more anxious about what might come and get me next, which might not be anywhere near as nice.
Yeah, very sensible. I mean, I also have I've got an LPA and I've got written all these things down. And it's really important to have those conversations with people so they know as much as they can and you can anticipate what you would want. For those patients, though, who haven't done that, you know, particularly the ones that you will encounter, and you and your colleagues, you know, you've never met them before. Suddenly they arrive in ICU unconscious after some catastrophic event. Let's say they lack capacity, they lack any real consciousness as well. To think about the clinicians, you and your colleagues, and the we call these the moral harms. Now, if you have that patient and their relatives who are insisting as much as they can insist on active treatment, even if you feel that it's not going to benefit them, they're never going to be discharged from ICU, they're never going to recover, and that treatment is causing them at the very least a burden, but probably more so some pain, quite significant discomfort. How do you and your colleagues cope with that, bearing that treatment responsibility?
It's a good question, and probably the answer is not very well, because we want to do good. We want to give people quality of life or quality of death. It is one of the huge privileges of an intensive care career that you have the chance potentially to save someone's life and return them to a life they want to live. But you are also able to help give someone a dignified and comfortable death too. Not give them by euthanasia purposes for absolute clarity, but one can give people the dignity and comfort of the end that they would choose to have. When you are being forced to do something where you feel that you are causing suffering for no gain to the patient, this isn't something where they're going to suffer for now, but you know what? Suck it up, because in a few months' time, you'll be glad that we did this for you. It's really hard, because these patients are often on the unit for a very long time, and it is difficult to get to the end of the bed every day, twice a day on a ward round, and feel that you're, and feel not guilty really for what you're doing to that patient. And it's difficult for doctors. And the doctors also find it difficult with the legal, well, certainly conflict. I mean, I certainly hate conflict, and I think a lot of people do. But the conflict too, and the legal process. Some people, lawyers, are very good at going to a court case and arguing a case, and they're not feeling emotionally affected. I feel it deeply. My skin is very thin, and I find it incredibly upsetting and stressful to even go through the legal process, let alone to sit in a court with someone pointing at me saying, that Dr. Montgomery's trying to murder my family member. It really hurts. But it is so much worse for the nursing staff, because they're at the bed for 12 hours. And we do see, without going to specific cases of my own, but we do see nursing staff leaving the profession because they just find it too difficult. And we see doctors leaving because they just don't want to go through that legal process yet again. And speaking personally, going without sleep for a few days isn't what will see me off the profession, but another legal case or two might. I just find it so stressful that I might leave. And it worries me, because when the trainees come through and they see that, some of them on those cases looking to go, well, this isn't a career I want to have. I don't want to get involved in things like this. So there is a consequence on staff, definitely. And I think that impact is probably much, much greater on the nursing staff, who, as you know, Rob, are really the saints of the peace in intensive care. I describe them as fighter jet pilots. I mean, they are managing 15 systems at once, whilst also trying to, deal with bodily functions and families. I mean, they are quite extraordinary in what they do. And it's a stressful enough job without going home in the evening and wondering what you've just done.
Completely. And I touched on it right at the beginning, and I think now is probably a good time to mention Townsend, which for listeners who don't know, it was a Court of Appeal decision, cases Townsend v. Epson and St. Heliers. And basically the case concerned, I don't need to go into the details, but it concerns life-sustaining treatment for a patient, and the patient actually since died. But it really, I suppose, the nub of it from the legal perspective and the consequences focus around the question of whether there's a difference between clinical judgment, clinical decisions about whether a treatment should even be on the table to offer a person, and best interests decisions. So let's take someone who has capacity, patient with capacity. What happens in real life, IRL, as my kids say, is that a doctor will have a conversation with a patient. You know, they've been diagnosed with, let's say they've been diagnosed with a cancer, and the doctor will say, right, these are the options available to you. And it includes, say, chemotherapy and radiotherapy and the option of not doing anything or perhaps surgery. What they won't discuss in that conversation are the things that either they don't think are appropriate, or more likely in those types of cases, perhaps they're not even available because perhaps the particular drug isn't endorsed, or it's too expensive, or it's just totally the wrong treatment to suggest. Or it might be even whether or not to admit someone to ITU or to put them on a ventilator. And no doubt those thoughts, conversations amongst colleagues would have been quite common during the COVID pandemic. And the patients without capacity, and that's what this Townsend case was really focusing on, obviously the doctors can't have those conversations with the patient themselves because they don't have the capacity to understand and communicate their decision. So they have them with, if they're around, they have them with those who know the patient best: husbands, wives, children, parents. And in the old days, before Townsend, again, the same conversations would take place. The doctor would explain the options available, the clinical options they've decided are the ones on the table. But the Court of Appeals said, though, that actually there might be other options that the patient, if they had capacity, would want to be considered in their best interests options, even if a clinician wouldn't be prepared to provide that treatment, say CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And if there is a dispute, so there's lack of consensus now after Townsend, those cases need to go to court for a judge to make that decision. So it's a very long explanation here, sorry. But if a judge does make that decision or takes the view that CPR, say, is in the patient's best interests, he or she can't force the doctors to provide that CPR, but it does create a tension, to put it mildly, I should say, between the clinical profession and the judiciary or the patient's relatives about what treatment should or shouldn't be provided.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
I think it's really difficult. I'm trying to navigate my way through the Townsend verdict by going back to my basics and sticking to the issues of best interests and overburdensome. We do, as I said earlier, we give a lot of thought to decision making, and it's exceedingly unlikely that you'd find someone else in Britain that would give a treatment that had no prospect of working at all. So that's a difficult problem to face. You're right about this issue of, we used to be able to say we cannot be made to do something we think is ethically and morally and actually practically wrong and ineffective.
Well, that's still true.
Yeah. Oh, well, you see, because that is helpful for, I say, sometimes for patients or relatives, it is easier for you to say that because they don't have to bear the guilt of, well, I said that they didn't do that. And then in 3 years, they're thinking, oh, maybe I should have pushed harder. It's sometimes easier for the family. And we do have to think of the family here about, as I said earlier on, you know, I often will say to people, like, look, I am paid, it's my job. I get a salary for living with guilt. And you don't. So let me take the guilt for you is sometimes the best way of trying to manage these things. But again, I can't reiterate enough. Please, everyone listening to this, just have the conversations with those you love. Hear what they have to say and tell them what you think, so that your general views about the way you would like to live life and what you would bear are known. I can't, you know, again, I won't give you specifics. In the last few weeks, I've been on intensive care and I had a really bad run of withdrawing care on people. But in most of those cases, it was because the family knew very well what their loved one would wish for, often in one particular case, a very young person. But it was very clear and they were at peace with communicating that. And just recently, a patient who very clearly communicated to me and said, thank you very much for all you're doing, but I'd like you to stop doing it now and I'd like you to make me comfortable. It's much easier when it's been thought about first.
I've kept you a long time. I just wanted to talk, if it's right, one other topic, which I mean, I find fascinating, and it rarely gets brought up in courts, partly because, or mainly because, the Mental Capacity Act is by nature designed to look at the individual. But there must be situations where commissioners, perhaps, or even big boss decision makers in trusts are faced with conflicts, if I can put it, use that word, between deciding to treat patient A or patient B. You know, and in the ICU context, you've got a certain number of beds and you may have two patients who need that one bed. In your view, one patient has a much, much lower prospect of being recovering or being discharged from ICU at the end of it. And the other patient, and I'm not talking about age necessarily, it could be for all kinds of reasons. You've got a finite number of resources. Is it impossible? How do you make that decision between who gets that treatment?
Well, it's really interesting you should ask, because, and I'm not sure anyone would believe me when I tell you that I've never, ever made that decision. I've never seen anyone have to make it. It's remarkable how, even when things are at their worst, again, credit to our nursing staff, you know, we're full. They are not staffed to take another patient. And you know what? But if there's another patient that needs the bed, they'll go, all right, then, we just got to bring them in. And if we end up with an extra one in, I'll be saying, okay, well, you can have one of my doctors as a nurse. We'll make this work. If we really have no physical capacity, we ring round London. We've got a transport team now. And actually, that really grew up in COVID particularly. We'd always done it, but it really took off then. So patients will move, they're known as non-clinical transfers. And done well by skilled intensivists with all the right equipment, really all you're doing is going from an intensive care to an intensive care that happens to be on wheels to another intensive care. And the impacts on the risk of a transfer, to my mind, are negligible. So I've never, ever had to make that decision, oddly. We make the decision on best interest still, and always have. And it was still the case in COVID. And I know when, you know, as you say, I chaired the UK National COVID Critical Care Committee, and you were on that. And we were having those conversations, weren't we, saying, what happens if? What happens if we are overwhelmed and we are having to make a choice between the 23-year-old gym bunny and the 98-year-old with dementia? But we never had to make those calls. We made the calls always just on best interest. So thank God it's never had to happen to me. I don't think it's ever likely to. I think there might be triaging decisions, like when bombs go off, that you do the stuff first that might save someone's instant life, and then the ones who look like they're dying, you come back to at the end and see if they're still alive. But that's not quite the same as rationing care, which I've never, honestly, I'm absolutely genuine with you, Rob. I've done this since 1989, my first ITU job, and I've never seen it anywhere I've worked, and I've never seen anyone else do it either. And I say, to reiterate, we never make decisions based on that. But from the outside, it is something society might consider. And I know that you and I have talked about this before, Rob, that I think we must find a way of making, if we are going to be going to court, making these things quicker, cheaper, but quicker and more painless and less adversarial, because going to court for a family is horrible. Meanwhile, the staff nurses and the doctors aren't liking it. Most lawyers don't really enjoy these sorts of cases terribly much. They're, you know, no one's really getting much out of this.
Completely agree. Let's find a new system. Hugh, thank you very much for a fascinating, really fascinating discussion. I feel we could have spoken for another 2-3 hours on this. I mean, futility is incredibly patient-specific. Probably even the wrong word to use, but saying, you know, one person's burden will be the next person's acceptable tolerance if it means that they can maintain a lifestyle that they can be fulfilled by. I suppose the real challenge is knowing what that person's tolerance would be, particularly when they're in front of your unconscious and they haven't written anything down. So, you know, if one message amongst many people can take from today's episode is, as you say, the absolute importance of having these conversations early on, and I mean early on from age 18 or even younger, with everyone who would want to listen to you, and write things down and make it clear, and write things down in a place and put them somewhere that your GP and any future healthcare professional seeing you would see. And there should probably be some kind of place we could upload these onto, some kind of portal that everyone can access, a bit like the Office of Public Guardianship with LPAs. Maybe that's another idea we can talk about.
Since rounding off on this, Rob, I mean, I have my death folder. Everyone around me knows exactly where it is. It's got everything. LPAs are in it. It's all there. You can have these conversations quite young. You and I have known each other a long time, Rob. And my elder son died when he was 17, very suddenly, in a drowning accident. But we'd had conversations about living and dying all his life. And it turned out that he'd had quite explicit and lengthy conversations with his friends about what he would want at his funeral. And so he was able to have those conversations. And I wouldn't say it was an enormous comfort, but at least we know what song he wanted and what reading he wanted and so forth. And the final frame, which I referred earlier, is a really easy way of having the conversations, because everyone can imagine, if they have a choice, what they would like that final frame to look like. And then everyone can be on one page as to how to navigate it. If anyone's interested, we've got an early website up for it, myfinalframe.com. And anyone can look. It's not much on it yet, but myfinalframe.com just sets out that little script for you.
Thank you. That's fascinating. We'll put that webpage on our program notes. Please do, everyone, give us feedback. Really interested for you to join the conversation. Expand on what we've discussed today if you've got any other thoughts. And do please give us ideas for next shows, next episodes. And please subscribe and like on your podcast platforms. Thank you very much, Hugh. It was fascinating.
Thanks for having me.